Did anybody find that meditation useful? A few heads nodding. Good. I think we often forget, don't we, the sense of we think we should have known better in hindsight. And we forget the fact that when we do the things we do, we didn't know better. That we should have known better is an opinion, isn't it? If we do stupid things, it's because we don't know better. So it's like, on one level, we know better. But when we do unskillful things, it means that we don't really deeply know better. It means that a form of delusion has clouded the mind. And I think sometimes if we don't like ourselves, this can be one of the causes for doing unskillful things. So a lot of people who don't like themselves tend to indulge excessively in sensuality. You want to escape that painful feeling inside, so you'll get lost in pleasure. So I think it's very important. Or if you don't have enough love inside, you get very angry when other people don't love you, because you feel without the love of others, you're not okay. So you get very anxious, very upset. So I think we do some of this practice, this forgiveness practice, and cultivate a lot of loving kindness, then when people aren't so kind to us, it doesn't matter as much, because we can be kind to ourselves. And we don't need as much sensual pleasure, because the mind can become a more pleasant place. We can just be with ourselves, and there's a certain amount of well-being there. It's pretty tricky though. You go down into that space of where all the pain is and all the memories are. You have to be a little bit heroic. Does anyone have any questions, comments?
Just a question on the last part of the meditation practice, whereby we sort of go through the sort of psychological walkthrough of the thing of the past, what had happened, that someone did bad to myself, or I've been done something bad for the others. It's some kind of a self-psychological analysis.
I wouldn't say psychological, no. No, because you're not at all going into the story.
That's the point I'm trying to make, because without being skillful in meditation, in knowing the mind, which mind we are looking at, the knowing mind and the action mind, without knowing which mind is actually knowing, which one is actually acting, we can be misled or deceiving ourselves that we actually fall into trouble playing the story ourselves. And then the more we analyze it, the more drama that we create in ourselves. So that can be quite dangerous to ourselves. How could we avoid it?
The thing is, when you come to do your meditation, if you're going to do some forgiveness meditation, this is one of the reasons I wanted to do it after people have been meditating already for half an hour. So generating sati. So hopefully the sense of self and all the stories calm down a bit, and then you set the intention, this is forgiveness meditation, and then I try to remind people of the fundamental, our intention here is to forgive, understanding that everyone makes mistakes, so it's not story time about what happened and how it shouldn't have happened and how you would have liked it to be. It's just the fact that it's more like, ouch, that hurt, the experience of dukkha, and that's the being that I perceived that hurt me, and I forgive them, because that's skillful. So it's like, that's a basic process, a basic method, and we have to be quite determined to stick with that method, and not to be put into the story. And there's other times where the story is useful. If someone really needs some therapy, fine. But when we come to do our Buddhist meditation practice, the practice of forgiveness, we're offering forgiveness. We have to be determined in the intention and determined to stay mindful with that's the object of the meditation, that I'm going to forgive, that I'm not going to think much about what happened, I'm just going to forgive what happened. Past is the past. It's gone.
And the past is the past. However, sometimes it carries into the future quite clearly, especially when you're talking about relationships that are quite meaningful to people.
Mm-hmm.
And although you embrace forgiveness and you forgive others and you forgive yourself, you try.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do when that's refused?
Oh, if you ask forgiveness from others and they don't give it?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's okay. So in your meditation, you're forgiving other people. And
yes.
You're forgiving yourself.
Yeah.
So what other people are doing is okay. Doesn't matter. In this practice, you're trying to deepen that refuge in you. And so whether other people forgive you doesn't matter. I mean, it would be nice if they do, but this is what we understand. Because of delusion, because of karma, because of habits, sometimes people forgive us when we ask, sometimes they don't.
Mm.
And there's one interesting thing the Buddha said: in the world there are two types of fools. And one fool is, having done something wrong, doesn't ask forgiveness. The other fool, having had something done wrong and having been asked to offer forgiveness, doesn't give forgiveness. And the Buddha says that person is a fool. Because the Buddha's understanding is that it's painful for people to not feel forgiven. When they recognize they've done something wrong and they ask for forgiveness, if the forgiveness isn't given, it is painful. But we can't make people forgive. So we can ask sincerely, and if they don't, that's okay. And then I think really important to drop any guilt, though, at least. If one asks forgiveness, one asks forgiveness. One did what one could. Sometimes people, there's a certain, if you're not committed to developing some insight into not-self, there's a certain kind of enjoyment that comes from holding on to grudges and not giving forgiveness, isn't it? It's kind of, no, I'm right, and I'm going to die being right. And it's like, and people do. People take all sorts of grudges to the grave.
Acha, what is the chance that this practice of self-love and self-loving kindness would lead to a narcissistic attitude or practice?
I think loving kindness is, I have faith that loving kindness is at the extreme end of wholesome. And so when you're picking up we have a wholesome mind state and unwholesome mind state. So we're talking about the very extreme of the wholesome spectrum. So I think if one is really setting the intention to have loving kindness meditation and really doing that, I don't think it's going to lead to narcissism. I think it possibly could even heal narcissism. It sensitizes the mind to other beings' loving-kindness practice. So if you do a lot of loving-kindness practice, a lot of forgiveness practice, your heart becomes more sensitive, you become more aware of the suffering of others. It's an experience of many meditators. If you do an enormous amount of loving-kindness practice and you really get attached to it and you don't contemplate not-self, you could get born as a Brahma-deva, whose radiance fills the whole universe, and maybe there is a certain narcissism in that. But this is maybe once we've got metta jhana, we can worry about that. If you don't yet have metta jhana, I don't think we need to worry about. The thing is, people who do have powerful metta jhana, this is the thing about loving kindness, that eventually it starts with thoughts and feelings and intentions, becomes a type of samadhi, it leads to jhana. So it becomes a very profound type of concentration, if trained in with discipline. This is a thing of Buddhist contemplations, they balance each other. Contemplations on not-self, contemplations on death. Most people who cultivate loving-kindness sincerely become more sensitive to other beings and more careful. Yeah. And I think narcissism is more born from that feeling that you have to take care of yourself and you have to take what you can because no one else is going to help you. It's kind of a less sensitive state.
Ajahn, I knew a person who is a perfectionist. So whenever she or he do things wrong, he or she will not forgive themselves. And one way, they created hell for themselves. The other way, they do things, they strive for the best. So when you give a task to him, he do it perfectly. Try their best to do good. So he doesn't really forgive himself so much, but the result is he probably deliver better job than the person who easily forgives themselves. Because he can keep saying, oh, I break these cups, that's okay. I neglected these kids. So he fell, but that's okay. So
sounds painful to me.
So
yeah, maybe you get some good external results sometimes, but it sounds painful. It's a painful experience to be living. Just because you forgive yourself doesn't mean that you don't try to do well, I think. You still try to do your best.
So this sense of guilt is quite strong in Asian culture. It could come from parents or the cultural influence. Mm. So so we don't need to go through the course of it. All we need to do is just remind ourselves to forgive ourselves, to put it down.
Yeah.
And no need to go through why, how, and parents.
With forgiveness, one also sets the intention to try not to do it again. One does do that. But it's very important to really completely forgive. And then setting the intention to try not to do it again actually helps us forgive, because we feel like, well, it was wrong and it was stupid. And I don't want to do it again. And so you make a kind of a commitment, okay, well, I'm really going to try not to do it again. And that helps us put it down. But depends which Asian culture you're talking about has guilt, because in the Thai language there isn't even a word for guilt, and no word for guilt, and also in the Tibetan language. And it was Western students that had to explain this concept to their Asian teachers, and they didn't understand it for a long time. And why would you hate yourself? They didn't get it at all. So, but I think possibly in Chinese culture, it's a bit the Confucian thing.
Yeah, and the Chinese culture, the parents always said, you're not doing very well with your mess results.
Yeah, there's a lot of pressure in ambition. And Thais, they have this word, sabai, which means, you know, sabai means everything's fine. And so you ask people, how are they? And they go, I'm sabai. And, you know, it's nice. You see the way they walk, even all the children can sing, and they can all sing beautifully, and they just walk with this light, like look like they're walking on air, and they just don't do guilt, and their parents, like when the kids are crying and running around, parents let their kids run around and cry, they let babies be babies, and when they fall over, they don't also try to restrain them. They fall over, they hurt themselves, they cry, the mums pick them up, you know, until they stop crying, they put them down, and they run around again, And there's this sense of kind of a bit more shared parenting and stuff, at least in the villages. And there's not so much guilt. And then one of the reasons they respect monks and nuns is because they give up what they can't give up. There's kind of a humble acceptance of kilesa. It's like they know they're greedy, they know they're angry. That's normal. And they don't even think that they should be doing much better. It's the monks are wonderful because they're trying to do something about it, you see. But everyone else is just like, well, there's another word, tamada. It's like, well, it's normal, isn't it, Ajahn? So, but these are those Southeast Asian cultures, I think, are traditionally, because of the weather, very warm, the abundance of food, and then the presence of Buddhism for 1,000 years, get a lot of very okay people. They've got other problems, a certain kind of ambivalence and laziness, because they don't have the same oppressive mental states that we want to do something about, a lot of them. But of course it's changing. It's changing a lot. Big cities everywhere in Asia and industrialization.
Yeah, I've been to Thailand, and when I witness there are some issues with like prostitution for women, all of that.
Yeah.
And I think this is a Thai is a Buddhism country, and how come this prostitute thing is so obvious in
society? This is the thing again, the absence of guilt, so it's not judged harshly. You see.
So they accept it.
Yeah. So it's like if that's the choice you make, you want to be a prostitute.
That's very.
And it's kind of pragmatic. It's like a lot of those prostitutes have paid for their brothers to go to university.
And the parents accept it and think.
A lot of those prostitutes have paid for the parents' house.
Wow.
Yeah.
And the parents doesn't have a sense of guilt.
Of course, if they're good middle class people, they wouldn't like their children to be prostitutes. And but you know, if they're poor. And if they're stuck in a muddy field and they've got a debt, and if one of their daughters or and sometimes sons goes and sends back some money and they pay off the debt and one of the kids goes to university, it's tolerated. The other thing about prostitution in Thailand is that I think the prostitutes which service the foreigners is about 5 or 10% of the total prostitute population. So 90% of the prostitutes in Thailand have Thai customers. So it's, like I said, it's like sensuality with the Thais is like, it's just what you do. And that's why the monks are, okay, put food in their bowls because they're not doing it. So it's, you know, I'm not saying it's so good, but I'm saying there's not much guilt there.
And,
yeah. Well, that's abuse, isn't it? That's child abuse. Yeah, I don't think that in traditional Thai culture, I don't think it was. I think that's a more modern thing. Yeah, I don't think. It's a more modern thing, isn't it? But I think you can say that ethics and virtue is degenerating globally, motivated by money. So then you see this occurring in traditional Asian cultures as well, unfortunately. But so we can be virtuous. We'll take care of our own minds.
Mm-hmm. I think as a mentee person, it is easy for us to give something wrong with us, but suppose that if somebody else, suppose we help somebody and for no reason, if they are reacting in a bad way, How do we say that I don't have any anger or ill will towards that person, but sometimes there's unpleasant feeling that why did it happen and how can we deal with it? So how do we do that?
No, I don't quite understand your question.
Somebody else, suppose that I help somebody,
mm-hmm.
but that person for some, I don't know the reason, but he or she reacting, you know, like angry and, so then how do we treat in meditating?
Yeah, also it's equanimity. One of the things which balances loving kindness and compassion. So equanimity. This is the question as well. You ask forgiveness, they don't offer forgiveness. Equanimity. You try to help somebody, they get angry.
Yeah.
Equanimity. So it's like, this is the thing we're talking about. It's like, it gets more and more obvious when we apply this right view that people are deluded. It's like, they often don't make sense. You do think something that you think will make them happy and they get angry.
Yeah.
You sincerely say sorry and they hurt you again. It's like, this is the thing, we're not the only ones who are experiencing confusion and acting irrationally at times. Other people are too. This is because of ignorance and delusion. So equanimity, you must understand, this is the way deluded beings are.
Yeah, but the thing is, although we are not angry or something, we do have unpleasant feelings.
Yeah. So that's your loving kindness practice to yourself in the moment that you're feeling an unpleasant feeling. Yeah. Loving kindness to yourself, equanimity towards them.
Could you say a few words about the word equanimity in the Buddhist context, please?
Okay, equanimity, I think the most important thing which helps give rise to equanimity is insight and wisdom. So that's it. So once you develop a bit of conceptual wisdom, you can apply that conceptual wisdom, and then once you've had insight, you can apply it. But one thing is very important to help us develop equanimity is understanding a belief in karma. So this is very helpful in being equanimous. When painful things affect us, if we can understand that we must have done things in the past which affected beings in certain ways that they felt pain, now things are ripening, beings are doing things and this being's feeling pain, this can be very helpful. That we accept karma as a doctrine. And then it's not self. I was talking about in the end. It's like, okay, there's this story and there's this being and there's this other being and there's this tremendous hurt, which is quite real. And then we try to respond to that with skillfulness, but then also when we reflect on it, okay, where's the self in that experience? The thing is going through the body parts or observing that the breath comes and then stays and then ceases, comes and then stays and then ceases. No self. Feelings arise, stay, cease. Where's the self? No self. That you apply mindfulness in this body. Okay, where's the self? Where's the self? When there's good mindfulness, apply it to feelings. Okay, where's the self? Is that emotion a self? A thought? Okay, that thought's gone. No thought. Another thought, it's gone. Where's the self? No self. So it's like, you do this again and again and again and again, and then you understand that conventionally there's selves, but you don't take it so seriously. You see? You know, I think enlightened beings, they're aware of they still have their characters and their personalities, but they never think it's a self for a second, you see. But because of conventions, they can relate to other beings. It's like, I sometimes see it as like the analogy as being, if someone's on top of the mountain, they can see where someone else is on the mountain, and they can say, so if you're still a self, and that person has realized not self, they can say, you know, the next step you need to take to get to the top of this mountain is this, and they'll be talking to them as a self. But they don't think, even in that process, that they're a self. So that's the result of having a lot of insight, you see. But until then, we train in insight, we investigate, okay, where is the self? But I think when you're confronted with the experience of pain and there is a big feeling of self, the appropriate response is kindness. And then when one has kind of pacified that to some degree, you can investigate. One investigates with a gentle determination. It's like because sometimes we can bring an almost abusive quality to our vipassana, our investigation. It's like, I'm going to destroy this self with wisdom. It doesn't work. It's like wisdom is born in a very calm, peaceful mind. So the loving kindness, I think, is a foundation for that calm and peacefulness, necessary foundation. So I wish everyone success in establishing that foundation and being liberated. Please wish me success in that process too.